I have lots of study guides, just I gather in my office. I just couldn't carry them all down. So I've got plenty to see me after class. Okay, so this is Bio 160, and we're talking cardiovascular system, and in particular the heart. We're going to still finish up the heart today. We were talking last time about the heart, a whole bunch of stuff about the heart, namely its size, its location, and chambers. Probably we got as far as valves, I believe. So let's just see what we can remember. How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
And how many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Four. Yeah, just kind of yell that out. Now the tricky part is to know, I smell something burning. Nice. Okay, the names of the chambers you got to remember, as well as the names of the valves. So this is, let's see, Bio 160, March 29th, the last day of class before spring break for most of us, unless you have classes tomorrow on Friday. All right, so let's take a look at the heart and just kind of review what we talked about last time with pictures this time. And you'll probably see that the pictures in the book are not as good as my drawings, but they're close. So here is that heart, and what is this pointy end called? That's the apex, right? And then the more flat end up over here, that's the base. So think of the heart as being a triangle, but it's what? It's an upside down triangle. And the heart that you're looking at right here is as if you're looking at the heart that's right inside my body. All right, so this part over here is the left side, and this part right over here is the right side. And this right here, this cardiac vein, separates the right side from the left side. So that's always easy to see. So now we know, since we see this nice diagonal stripe right here, what the anterior side of the heart is, you know, the superior part, the inferior part. So you know pretty much everything about how to look at the heart. So when you start looking at a heart, look for those three things. The apex, the base, and then this nice big stripe right on the heart, if you can see it from the outside. Okay. And what else can you tell me about the heart by looking at it? Is it straight upside down or is it tilted? Yeah, it's tilted, right? It's tilted over to the left, and what you can't see, as you go from base to apex, the apex actually starts to point out of your body, right? So it's up against your chest wall, and you can feel it. We call that the point of maximal impulse, or the PMI. So if you want to know exactly where your heart is, all you have to do is kind of palpate around and find where your heart is just pounding up against your chest wall. All right, so we looked at that. One thing we didn't cover, because I didn't want to draw it out, and that is the pericardium. The pericardium is a series of membranes that surround the heart. And there's three of them. So here we have that nice diagram of the heart. And if we make a cross section at about this level of the heart and take a look, we can see a couple layers. Well, first, the muscle part is what we call the myocardium, right here. There is a membrane that lines the inside of every chamber. We call that, bless you, we call that the endocardium. And then there's a layer that's right on the surface, the superficial surface of the heart. We call that the epicardium. So those are the three layers of the heart. The epicardium, the myocardium, and what's the myocardium made out of? Muscle, right? And then the endocardium is very similar to the epicardium. And the endocardium has a pretty nice function to it. It's very smooth and slippery. Why do you think it needs to be smooth? Because in that last chapter, what was that last chapter all about? We looked at blood, and one of the functions of blood was to stop you from bleeding to death. We call that coagulation. So if this was a rough surface inside the heart, that would have a tendency to start blood coagulating just right inside the heart. And maybe it wouldn't form a blood clot in the heart, but if the heart pumped it out and it went to some other place in your body, like your brain, that would cause a stroke. So the inside part of the heart has to be very smooth, and so it's lined with endocardium. Okay. Well, let's look on the inside of the heart. This, I'm sure, is an exam figure. So you should be really familiar with this diagram. Should be able to label this real quickly. So again, We got the apex of the heart and the base up over here, and then a bunch of great vessels coming off the base. And we can now see the chambers. So this side, what side of the heart is this right over here? Yep, and this one over here is the left. All right, so the chambers, the inferior chambers are the big pumping chambers. So they're called ventricles. So here's a ventricle, and here's a ventricle. So this would be the right ventricle. This would be the left ventricle. And the left ventricle pumps blood everywhere in your body. The right ventricle just pumps blood to your lungs. So that's a very short distance. That means that the left ventricle has to be a lot stronger. It needs to develop a lot more pressure than the right ventricle, because the right ventricle just goes to the lungs. Can you tell by looking at the free wall of the ventricles which one looks stronger to you? And does that correlate with how far it has to go? Don't forget, this is the left side here, and this is the right side over there. Which one looks stronger? Left. What are you looking at when you say left? I like your answer a lot, but what are you looking at? It's bigger. Look at the thickness of the wall. Look at the thickness from here to here compared to the thickness from here to here. Which one's thicker? Yeah, the left. So the left ventricle definitely is a lot stronger because it has to develop more pressure to force blood everywhere in your body. But the right ventricle, on the other hand, is weaker because it only has to pump blood through your lungs, which is not very far at all. Okay. So if you're ever confused when you're looking at a heart as to which one is the right or left ventricle, just look at the thickness of the wall right there, and it should be real obvious which one it is. Okay, if you're ever dissecting a heart or whatever in any of your classes. All right, so those are the two chambers. There's a partition between those ventricles, and we call that the interventricular septum. Interventricular septum. So a septum is just anything that separates one cavity into two. Like this thing right here that separates your nasal cavity into a right and left, that's a nasal septum. Okay, so that's just what we call a septum. And then here are the atria. Here's the right atrium, here's the left atrium. And guess what? There's a septum between the atria as well, but I don't know if it's probably not labeled on this diagram, but there's a separation between the atria too. Okay, so that's the chambers and the septum. So what else do we know here? Let's look at valves. You said that there are four valves in the heart. All right, so first off, let's consider the atrioventricular valves. Now, when I say atrioventricular, what does that bring to mind? Atrioventricular, it has something to do with what? An atrium and a ventricle? Atrioventricular, and as a matter of fact, there is a valve between the atria and the ventricles. And so we call it an atrioventricular valve. Here's the one on the right side of the heart. Here's an atrioventricular valve. Right here, we call that the tricuspid. And then there's a corresponding one on the left side of the heart as well. So atrium and ventricle on the left side. Here is the atrioventricular valve on the left side of the heart. We call that the bicuspid. And let me tell you why. Because the tricuspid valve has three of these leaflets that open and close, open and close, open and close. So it's the tricuspid. And on the left side of the heart, there's only two that open and close. So it's called the bicuspid. But since we opened up the heart, maybe you can't see all of the cusps or leaflets right there, but that's how many they have. Sometimes you might actually have to call this bicuspid valve a different name. It goes by the name of mitral valve as well, because that's a form of a hat that certain people wear. A mitre. A mitre is a hat that you can fold flat. It's got two parts, but then you can kind of unfold it and like this so that it's not just flat and stick it on your head like that. Who wears a hat that looks like that? Pope. Yeah, the Pope does, right? The Pope. Or a bishop or a cardinal wears these fancy hats that have the little pointy top to it. It looks like a mitre. All right, so we call that the mitral valve. So blood can flow past these valves like this, in which case the valves open up. But when blood tries to go back, right, it pushes up against the valve leaflets, and what happens? they slam closed. As a matter of fact, they make a big, huge noise when they slam closed, and that prevents blood from going into the left ventricle back up into the right ventricle. And I think we talked about that last time, why that's important. Why is that important? Why are those valves important right there? Did we talk about that last time? Yeah, because remember, for instance, the heart has got to pump blood in one direction through the heart. But if blood is able to leak back, think of yourself going up the steps. Did I mention that last time? If you go up the steps, if you take 5 steps up, but then you got to go 5 steps back down, and then you go 5 steps up again, but then you have to go 5 steps down, are you ever going to go anywhere? No, right? So if the heart has these leaky valves, it will be pumping blood, but it's going to end up back where it came from, and that's going to kill the heart. And then, of course, it's going to kill you, so it's not very good at all. So that's the purpose of those valves. So those are two, and these are both atrioventricular, the tricuspid and then the bicuspid. Now, how are you going to remember which one is which? Did I tell you that little saying that I think of sometimes? Yeah, try before you buy. So as you look as you read from left to right, you try before you buy, right? So that's tricuspid, bicuspid. So that's just a little, almost like a mnemonic that you can use to remember the names of those valves. Question on that? No? Okay. All right, so that's two. Guess what? There are two more valves that you have to be familiar with. And that is, there are valves, once blood is pumped into an artery, for instance, here is an aorta, and here is a pulmonary artery. I only see one more on this diagram because the other one's been cut off. But nonetheless, here is the aorta. We don't want blood going from the aorta back into the heart because that's going to kill the heart as well. So here is a valve that prevents retrograde flow of blood from the aorta back into the left ventricle. And we call that the aortic valve, or sometimes the aortic semilunar valve. And there's a corresponding valve between the pulmonary artery and the right ventricle. And again, then we would just call it the pulmonary valve, or the pulmonary semilunar valve. So those are the four valves. I've got maybe another picture I can show you all the valves all together, but there are four. Now, what we haven't done so far, I don't think, is define what an artery is and what a vein is. That seems pretty simple, okay? What the heck is an artery? Who could give me a definition of an artery? What is an artery? Have you heard of an artery before? I'm sure everybody's heard of an artery. So, okay, an artery takes blood away from the heart. That's what an artery is, okay? And what about a vein? It's just the opposite definition. It brings blood back to the heart. So no matter what is contained in that blood, right, as long as it's moving away from the heart, it's an artery. If it's coming back to the heart, we call that a vein. Whether it's oxygenated blood or deoxygenated blood, it really doesn't matter. Okay. A couple other things in the heart that you should be familiar with, besides the septum and the ventricles and the atria and the valves. Notice that these atrioventricular valves right here and right here have a little cord attached to them here and here. Can you see these little cords? Probably. I can see them on the screen. If I can see them, you could probably see them when it's projected. It's a little bit better. These are what we call chordae tendineae. They attach a valve leaflet and anchor it to the myocardium itself. And it anchors it to a papillary muscle. So these little finger-like projections coming up inside the heart, like your little fingers right there, those are papillary muscles. And they hold on to the chordae tendineae, and the chordae tendineae hold on to the atrioventricular valves. And guess why that happens? Or think, for instance, what would happen if these valve leaflets right here weren't tethered, if they didn't have these chordae tendineae? So as blood forces them closed, what would happen to them if they weren't tied down? They would just pop open the other way, right? They would just flop open and then flop close, open like that. They would just flop back and forth, and they wouldn't work like a valve at all, and then that would kill the heart. So these chordae tendineae hold the valve so that when the heart contracts, they come together and they never invert or they never prolapse. They just occlude very nicely. All the leaflets just approximate each other, and that seals off the ventricle. So that's real important. But they don't work right in all people, Sometimes somebody has a leaky valve, right? And we call that an insufficient valve. It produces a murmur, and then that has to be repaired somehow, maybe with a valve replacement. Maybe it can be repaired with surgery. And if it needs to be replaced, sometimes we put in a synthetic valve, or sometimes we put in a pig heart valve, or maybe even a valve from somebody else. What can you tell me about that somebody else then? Yeah, they're dead, right? So you get a valve from a cadaver, and that valve from a cadaver keeps you alive. So that's just one of the choices you would have to make if you ever needed a valve, if it couldn't be replaced. You could get a prosthetic one, or a cadaver valve, or another valve from a different kind of animal. Okay? What might be a drawback by getting a valve from a cadaver? What do you think? Because it's a trade-off. There are some good reasons why, but there's always some bad reasons why. If you get a valve from a cadaver from another human, what do you have to be concerned about? Oh, rejection is always the case, but if you got one from a pig, you'd have rejection too as a possibility. But I like that answer. Okay. Now, if you get a prosthetic valve, you don't have to worry about rejection because your body isn't going to recognize it as foreign tissue. So that's one nice thing about getting a man-made valve, one that's made out of plastic. But if you get one that was alive at one time, one of the things, if it's a human, you have to be concerned about is infectious. If it is infectious, because you could get AIDS from it, you could get hepatitis and things like that. All right, so that's always a risk that you take. Now, it can be screened. A hospital can screen for those diseases, but is a hospital always 100% right? No, unfortunately. Really?
They didn't screen the donor, and he had AIDS.
Oh, that's a shame. Yeah, you know, I bet it happens. I'm not familiar with that particular case, but I'm going to catch up with the news next week. But, yeah, no, we do talk a lot about current events in here. It certainly does happen. Or there's other diseases that you can get to. And, you know, at any time, anybody can make a mistake, and that's just the way it goes. All right, but if you get a pig valve, you don't have to worry about infection, but then the valve probably won't last as long, won't fit quite as right, and maybe rejection is a little bit more of a possibility. So you have to take anti-rejection medication whenever you get a transplant. So that's certainly a downside, and you can never get off of that anti-rejection medication your whole life. It can be reduced and reduced and reduced, but you can never ever stop taking it because then it will be rejected, and then what? And you need open heart surgery again, and you probably don't want to go through that too many times. Right. But if you get a prosthetic valve, you don't have to worry about infection. You don't have to worry about rejection. But you have to worry about something else, and that is, remember the inner lining of the heart was made of that endocardium, which is real, real smooth. All right, these artificial valves are not smooth. So they have a tendency to form blood clots. And then you could end up with a stroke or a heart attack or something like that. So if you get an artificial valve, then you have to be on anticoagulation therapy for the rest of your life, like Coumadin. Okay, what we typically call blood thinners. So you just kind of have to choose what you think might be best for you with your particular circumstances. And then if you're a young person, what's going to happen to your heart? It's going to grow and get bigger. And that valve that you got as a young person isn't going to grow, whether it's a pig heart or cadaver valve or especially a prosthetic valve. So then some later time, you realize that you have to go back and get it replaced with one that fits your heart as it grows up. Okay? What causes that? Sometimes, you know what, a lot of times it could be due to a viral infection. And as a matter of fact, that the virus only attacks these valves. So you don't really know you're sick. It's not like you have the flu or anything. And then all of a sudden you start having symptoms like you're having a heart attack. You're going to be short of breath and lethargic, and then they'll do some imaging and find out, or ultrasound, for instance. Yep, they can have it. So another case, instead of getting an infection that develops over your lifetime, we would call that a developmental problem. You could be born with a valve that doesn't work right, and we call that a congenital problem. So it could be developmental or it could be congenital. If it's bad enough, if it's bad enough, yeah, we want to treat it right away. open heart surgery, either replace it or a lot of times the first choice would be, can we repair the valve? If we can repair it to where we bring back the function, then that's great. Then we don't have to rip it out of somebody's body and replace it with something else. Okay? But one thing about the heart, if you let those valves go for too long, if they're really sick, it's going to kill the heart. And then the heart gets to a certain point to where even if you replace the valve, the heart's going to die anyway. So, and that's the job of the cardiologist to find out where you are in that process, and then he or she is going to tell you, you got to get rid of that valve next week. Or you might get to a point to where we can't bring the heart back. So that's how important those valves are. Okay. All right, so how many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Got four. All right, let's look at the whole circulatory system all put together with the heart and the lungs and some blood vessels. So this is a circulatory system, blood flow through the heart. Okay, so this thick chamber right here, what's the thick chamber? The thick chamber is the, is it the right or left? Yeah, it's the left ventricle, and the thin one, can you see that thin one? That's the right ventricle. And the left ventricle is real strong because it's got to pump blood through your whole body. And this, we can't even draw the whole body on this diagram right here, but we can see capillaries that are supposed to represent your whole body. Like these up over here are in your brain, and these are everything below the level of the heart. So here we have a vessel taking blood away from the heart. What do we call a vessel that takes blood away from the heart? Artery, right? That's an artery. Here's another vessel that's taking blood away from the heart. We call that an? Aha. It has a different color, so maybe you chose a different word, but blood away from the heart means what? Artery, regardless of what color it is, right? So this is the pulmonary artery right here. This is the aorta. That's an artery, even though it's different colors. All right, now here, let's look at this. Look at this vessel. It's bringing blood back to the heart. What's that? That's a vein. And here's a vessel bringing blood back to the heart. That's a vein. Now let's look at some other different, oh, they don't have arrows. I got to draw an arrow in here. It's bringing blood back to the heart. What are those things that I just drew in? Those are veins as well, okay? But you notice they have different colors. So let's see if we can understand why this diagram has different colors associated with it. But don't forget, away from the heart is artery, to the heart is a vein. Let's start exactly here in the right ventricle. It's going to pump blood, and blood can't go into the right atrium because of what? The tricuspid valve is going to prevent it, which is fantastic. So blood is going to get pumped from the right ventricle into the pulmonary artery. And whenever you hear that term, pulmonary, you should think of lungs. Lungs. Whenever you hear myocardium, you should think of the heart. Okay, so pulmonary, like a pulmonologist is a physician that deals with the lungs all the time. Cardiologist deals with the heart, right? All right, so pulmonary artery is taking blood to the lungs, right? That's an artery away from the heart to the lungs. And the color of that blood you see right there is blue. And that just means it is low on oxygen, right? It has a lot of CO2 from cellular respiration in it. But it's going to the lungs. That's a good thing because in the lungs, that's where exchange takes place. That's where CO2 is going to leave the blood. And what do you got in your lungs? Oxygen, right? So oxygen is going to go from your lungs into the blood. And when that happens, it changes color. It becomes red. It's carrying oxygen. But in order to get to the rest of your body, it's got to go back to the heart. So since it's going back to the heart, what is that vessel called? Is it an artery or vein? Somebody said vein, and you're exactly right. So even though it's oxygenated, it's still a vein. These are the pulmonary veins going back to the left atrium. The left atrium pumps it past the bicuspid valve into the left ventricle, and you can see the nice thick ventricles right there. And the left ventricle then pumps it into the aorta. So the aorta is an artery. It's taking blood away from the heart, and it carries oxygenated blood, which is fantastic because that oxygenated blood is what is going to feed and nourish the rest of your body, right? Your brain and your digestive system and everything else. So blood from the aorta goes to your brain and goes to every place else. We call these systemic capillaries, capillaries all over your body. And what happens in these capillaries? Oxygen leaves, CO2 goes in, and that blood then returns to the heart. And since this blood is returning to the heart, do we call this an artery or a vein? That's a vein. Okay. But these veins right here are so big, we give them a special name. We call it the vena cava. It just means big cavernous vein. And there's an inferior one and a superior one, and so that's how they're called. Inferior vena cava, superior vena cava, and they attach to the right atrium. And I think that's pretty much where we started. Okay? So these veins are bringing back what? Deoxygenated blood or high in CO2 to the right side of the heart. Then the right side of the heart pumps it to the lungs where CO2 goes out, oxygen goes in, and then it comes back to the left side of the heart that pumps it to everywhere else in the body. So that is the whole circulation with and how the heart fits in there. So just by saying blood has high in CO2, you can't say it's an artery or a vein. It all depends on which way it's going. That's the major definition right there. Okay. And that's the importance of the heart for pumping blood everywhere, because the blood is going to deliver oxygen to all those different parts of your body. Okay. So what does your heart have to do every day of your life? It's got to pump, right? It just can't ever take a break. It's going to pump and pump and pump and pump. So there's something inside the heart that makes sure that that happens. As a matter of fact, these things are so good at what they do that if we were to take a heart out of somebody or an animal and put it on the table, just like Raiders of the Lost Ark, what's going to happen? It's still going to beat. A heart can beat on its own. It doesn't need a nerve supply in order for it to beat. And that's because there's some special things inside the heart that will control the heart rhythm all by itself. And those things we call the conduction system of the heart. So there are specialized muscle cells inside the heart that will act like the nerve supply. But they're really muscle cells. They just don't contract, but they carry electrical signals. The first part is the sinoatrial node. And on the slide, what do you see it called? SA node. And that stands for sinoatrial node because it's in the right atrium right here. These cells will depolarize and cause electrical information to flow over both of these atria right here. And when that electrical information flows over the atria, that's a signal for them to contract. So what do you think happens? Do you think the atria contract first or the ventricles contract first? The atria contract first because it has the SA node. All right, if that... Oh, and you know what? The SA node sometimes is called a pacemaker of the heart. So this regulates the heart rate. So the ventricle doesn't have a pacemaker. The pacemaker is in the... SA is in the right atrium. Okay. Then that electrical activity goes down over here at a junction between the atria and the ventricles. So we call that the atrioventricular node. But usually we don't spell it out. We just say what? AV for atrioventricular. And the atrioventricular node is the only way that that electrical signal can get from an atrium into the ventricle. Can't get there any other way. Can't go through the valve. Can't go through the side of the wall over here. The only way is the AV node. And the AV node holds on to that electrical signal for a split second. And then after that time, it lets the electrical signal out through the AV bundle. And then we have the bundle branches right here, which distribute the electrical signal over the rest of the heart. So after that, after the electrical signal is distributed over the ventricles, guess what the ventricles do? Then they contract. So the electrical activity is just the signal for contraction. So again, probably what's real important for you to see is that the atria contract first, help fill up the ventricles with blood, and then that electrical signal is released from the AV node, runs very fast down the bundle branches down to the apex of the heart, and then it starts coming back up the free wall and causing these parts of the heart to contract, especially these apical regions first, and then these regions here, and then these regions here, like so. Okay, now why is that important? Well, let's just say that contraction started here and it forced a bunch of blood down into the ventricles. But what would happen if this part of the heart, if the more basilar regions of the ventricle started to contract, if it started contracting here, which way would blood be forced? Blood would be forced down into the apex. And then where would it go? It would be stuck down there, right? So what has to happen is that the apex has to start contracting and pinching blood so that it gets, what, ejected out of the base of the heart. So let me go back to that previous slide. So how does that work? The way that blood leaves the heart is either through the aorta, which is up over here, or the pulmonary artery. So the heart has to contract down here first, forcing blood up. If the heart was contracting here first and then moving down, where would blood be forced? Down into the apex, and then it has no place to go. So the conduction system is real important for coordinating the heart and telling which parts of the heart to contract when and at what time so that blood is ejected in the right way. So I think you should know how the conduction goes. It starts with what? SA node. What's another name for SA node? Pacemaker. That's the pacemaker of the heart. And what is that? What does that signal? It signals some part of the heart to contract. Which part of the heart does that signal to contract? Yeah, where is it located? Where is that SA node located? In the right atrium. So the SA node signals the atria to contract. It signals the atria to contract. Okay, and then that signal goes all over the atria and it gets to the atrioventricular node that's at the junction of the atria and the ventricles. And then from the AV node goes into the AV bundle, the bundle branches, the Purkinje fibers, and then that stimulates the whole myocardium to contract, all the ventricles to contract. As a matter of fact, I don't talk about each one of these little boxes right here. But the ones that you should know are sinoatrial node, AV node, right, the bundle branches and the Purkinje fibers. That's how the signal goes through the heart. Okay, let's see if you can remember what I was talking about, and that is which chamber contracts first, or which chambers of the two, of the four, which chambers? Yeah, the atria contract first, followed by the ventricles. And that really makes perfect sense because the atria help load the ventricles with blood, and when they're filled with blood, then the ventricles contract and pump blood out of the heart. But don't forget, the ventricles should start contracting down from the bottom, forcing blood up, not contracting at the top, forcing blood down into the apex because it doesn't have any place to go. And the conduction system does a really good job of making sure that that happens. So here is what you have on your handout. The conduction system, it depolarizes. Ah, who can tell me something about depolarization? Whoa, depolarization. Tell me, what does depolarization mean in terms of an ion? Sodium, I like that ion. What's happening to sodium? Yeah, sodium is actually running into the cell. Right, down its concentration gradient, that's depolarization. Right, muscle cells also have to repolarize. What does repolarize mean? Potassium leaving the cell. So again, just like nerves and any other cell in your body, the heart works the same way. Sodium goes in, potassium goes out, that starts that action potential, right, that has the one component, depolarization. And when you have these ions moving around in there, that's a current. That forms an electrical current. And we can actually measure the current on the surface of our body. We can measure all those electrical events, all those millions of cells that are depolarizing and repolarizing produce an electrical signal on the surface of our body that we can measure. And guess what? What's the name of that electrical activity on the surface of your body that we can measure? I'm sure everybody knows what it's called, but you just haven't thought about it probably. It's that EKG, electrocardiogram. where people put electrodes, which are just electrical conducting pads on your skin, on your arms and legs, or maybe even on your chest. It's rare that we put them on your back, but I suppose we could put them on your back, and we can measure the electrical events inside your heart. And that's really nice because we can actually see things that are happening inside the atria differently from what we see inside the ventricle. And so we can look at the atria in particular or the ventricles, or maybe there's no communication between the atria and the ventricles, and we can learn a lot about the heart. All right, so I'm going to take the definition of the ECG off the screen and show you an ECG. There's an ECG. Have you ever seen something like this before? Oh yeah, it's in the movies all the time, right? And Star Trek or whatever, and you can see these lines going blip, 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 you know, and then when it goes flat, what's that? Yeah, it's bad, right? Then Dr. McCoy says in Star Trek, he's dead, Jim, right? That's his favorite line. All right, but nonetheless, this is an ECG, and you can see all these different waves, and we name the waves. And we start with P. I have no idea why we start with P. And we go P, Q, R, S, T, which is good. At least it doesn't go P, A, D, F or something, right? This P, Q, R, S, T, they're all consecutive letters. And this P right here represents the first event in the electrical activity of the heart. And what was that first event? Depolarization of the sinoatrial node, that's going to signal what? What to contract? It's going to signal the atrium, or both atria to contract. And that electrical event is so fast that this P wave right here represents depolarization of all the atria, both the right and left atrium. Okay? That's what that P wave is. All right? And then, where does that electrical activity from the atria go? Goes down to the atrial ventricular node, but it doesn't just scoot right through, it's held there, it's delayed in the AV node for a little bit, and then it's given to the ventricles and it signals the ventricles to contract. So let's look at this ECG again. So here's ECG. The P is depolarization of the atria. And then it goes to the AV node and it stops for just a short period of time. And then that depolarization starts up again in the ventricle, so this big QRS wave right here represents depolarization of the ventricles. All that sodium rushing into all those myocardial cells that are going to signal it to start to contract. And which tissue do you think has more mass to it or more volume? The atria or the ventricles? Which are bigger in terms of the amount of muscle that they have? The atrium or the ventricles? Well, let's go back and take a look. Here's an atrium here, and here are the ventricles. All right, how thick is this ventricle compared to this atrium? Oh, it's really huge, right? So there's a lot more tissue in the ventricles than there are in the atria. So maybe I would expect to get more electrical activity when the ventricles are depolarizing than when the atrium is depolarizing. And if we look at the ECG, is that what we see? Yeah, this P wave is actually pretty small compared to this big QRS wave. Because the QRS represents depolarization of the ventricles, ventricular depolarization. Okay. The last wave on an ECG is this T wave right here. And what follows depolarization? Repolarization, and this T wave right here represents repolarization of the ventricles. And it's pretty big, it's bigger than the P wave, but it just spread out over a longer period of time. So I think that's what's important for you to know. The only other thing that I have on my notes, and it's kind of a subtle point, but remember this is depolarization of the atria, right? But what do the atria have to do before they can depolarize again? Just like the ventricles repolarize, the atria have to repolarize as well. They repolarize at the same time that the ventricles depolarize. So you can't really see it on the ECG because that signal the repolarization signal of the atria is so small compared to the huge signal for ventricular depolarization that we don't really see it, but we know that it happens at the same time. So that's why on your study guide you have, right here, you see the QRS complex is what? Ventricular depolarization as well as atrial repolarization. But the T wave all by itself, that's just ventricular repolarization. Okay, so chances are you might see a question. Certainly on the study guide there's a question like that. All right, fibrillation. Fibrillation is really kind of a sad thing. If this is what a normal ECG looks like. And don't forget the, let me see if I have a different colored pen. Yeah, this is good. Okay, so what does this little guy right here look like? Right there. That's a P. And then this thing right here is a? Yeah, as a matter of fact, and if you said QRS complex, that's fine with me, but yeah, the Q would be here, R and S, so that's the R wave, or you could say QRS complex. That wouldn't bother me at all. And then this one right here is the T wave, right? All right, when somebody's in fibrillation, so this ECG is real important because it's controlling how your heart contracts, right? Atria, ventricle. But there is a time when those currents, instead of flowing through the conduction system nicely like we see here from SA node to AV node like this, there are currents that can actually kind of wrap around the heart like this and go all over the place. And as these currents wrap around the heart from right to left, guess what it's causing? The heart to contract from left to right, but it could be different than down over here. This part down over here could be contracting from left to right, while this part up over here is contracting right to left, and the heart could be contracting from top to bottom, right, if it loses coordination. And when that happens, the electrical signals, if they're just going all randomly moving around the heart, they don't look like an ECG, they look like this thing. I don't see any P waves. You see a QRS complex? No. It's all just random. And the heart is contracting randomly. And when the heart contracts randomly, guess what happens to blood flow through it? You know, blood just kind of gets there and gets pushed around inside the heart, but it never gets ejected. And that's very bad because no blood, no oxygen is getting to your brain. How long will your brain, when your heart, and that condition right there is called fibrillation. Your heart is fibrillating, and what it looks like is that the heart looks like it's just quivering. It's sitting inside your chest doing this, when it should be doing what? Contraction. Boom, 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 boom. All right, when it's fibrillating, it's just kind of quivering inside your chest. It's not pumping blood. And what period of time do you have consciousness? For what? You got 4 seconds. When your heart is fibrillating, you will lose consciousness in 4 seconds. And then when do you experience brain death? When you can't ever come back to life again? 4 minutes. So fibrillation is just a very critical event in the heart that's going to kill somebody very quickly. Oh, that's when they get those things out. Okay? And that is, well, what are those things? They're big electrodes, big paddles that they stick on somebody's chest, right? And it shocks the heart. Actually, it shocks the whole body, contracts. And if somebody's touching the body, they're going to get shocked too, and they're going to contract. But what happens then, okay, when the whole heart contracts at once, then that stops these little circular currents from going around everywhere in the heart. And the hope is, if you're lucky, then that the normal pacemaker will take over and the heart will stop beating normally again. Namely what? Atria, then ventricle. Relax. Atria, ventricle, and then relax. All right? It doesn't work always, but it works pretty nicely most of the time. The only trouble is, I don't see a defibrillator in the room. Okay? But probably, you know, in 20 years from now, all public places will have defibrillators that you can put on somebody's chest when they pass out unexpectedly, and the machine will be smart enough to know if they're in fibrillation or if they're in some other kind of problem. Because you only want to shock somebody if they're in fibrillation, not in some other kind of mode. And so, well, yeah, the machine will tell you, get back, clear, right? Because you don't want to, because if you give somebody electrical shock and their heart is normal, you can cause them to go into fibrillation. So the machine or who's ever defibrillating has to be smart enough to know, is it proper to defibrillate or not? Okay, and they're making machines now that are smart enough to look at an ECG and they can tell if it's fibrillation or some other kind of problem. And I know Disneyland has probably about four or five of these machines around, and a lot of places do have them now, but I don't know where the nearest one is around here. But fortunately, the paramedics are only about a block away. Okay, they're not too far. But even if you don't know the number for the paramedics, you can still, if somebody passes out, you still, if you're CPR certified, you can actually beat somebody's heart from their outside of their body, all right, even though you don't have a defibrillator. And how do you do that? How do you beat? Yeah, chest compressions, right? You learn how to do chest compressions, and you press on their sternum right here that compresses the heart. And because of the valves in the heart, that squirts blood into the arteries, and that keeps delivering oxygen, okay, to their brain and to their heart. The question was, when people have asthma, could they have heart problems? You know, they can develop heart problems. It might not be directly related to asthma, but okay, they have a hard time breathing because of what's happening in their lungs, not what's happening in their heart. But when your lungs aren't working right, that puts a lot of stress on your heart, and that could cause heart problems later. Okay. So when somebody has asthma, they have trouble inhaling and exhaling. Or when somebody has emphysema, they have trouble inhaling and exhaling. Two little bit different kinds of things, but those are problems with the lungs, not necessarily the heart. Okay. But that will make other conditions worse. If someone has heart disease or kidney disease or something like that, it will make those conditions worse when you have asthma or emphysema when you try to treat. Okay. Let's see, what should we talk about? Quiz. Oh yeah, we got a quiz coming up. Okay, heart sounds. Heart sounds aren't on the quiz, but none of this heart stuff is on the quiz. Heart sounds, it's pretty easy to understand heart sounds. You probably all heard heart sounds. You don't even need a stethoscope to hear heart sounds. You just put your ear up on somebody's chest and you can hear a bunch of noise in there. What does it sound like? Well, just like lubbed up, lubbed up, lubbed up. What's going on? What's going on when you hear those heart sounds? Well, let's see. I don't know if I got a slide in particular to heart sounds. Maybe. I suppose. Oh, yeah. Here we go. Here's a pretty nice slide. Right here. That's why you got to know about those valves that are inside the heart. So let's see. Which one of these do I like? You know, there's something else that I want to talk about just before. We talk about the heart cycle. The heart has two main phases to it. And you're probably all aware of that because when you get your blood pressure taken, how many numbers do they give you? Do they give you 10 numbers or one number or... Yeah, they give you two numbers. What the heck are those two numbers about? Okay. And some of you might be familiar already with that, and that's fantastic because, and that tells you a lot about the heart. The heart pumps blood. It's not like an electric motor constantly pumping blood. It's pumping blood when what happens? When it contracts. That's when it's pumping blood. And when it's relaxed, then it's not pumping blood. It's actually filling up with blood. So the heart cycle is kind of interesting. When it's relaxed, blood flows into it, which is real important because the heart can't pump any blood out unless what? Unless blood can get into it. So when the heart is relaxed, filling with blood, we call that diastole. That's in your notes. Where's diastole? Someplace. What page? Should I find it and show you? What page, what page, what page? Probably page one, huh? Yeah, page one. Here's page one. Blood flow through the heart, diastole and systole. So diastole is when the heart is relaxed, blood can flow into it. And when the heart is pumping, it contracts, blood is being pumped out, we call that systole. So it has those two phases, relaxation and then contraction. The relaxation phase is diastole, the contraction phase is systole. And your blood pressure is lowest when your heart is what? Contracted or relaxed? It's relaxed. That's your lowest pressure. And when your heart is contracted, that's your highest pressure. And so when we measure blood pressure, we can measure the highest pressure and the lowest pressure, and we report that number as the systolic over the diastolic pressure. And so the top number is usually bigger than the bottom number because that's when the heart is contracting. And you know what? You know what those numbers should be? I probably should say this because it's very 120 over 80. So systolic is 120, 80 is diastolic pressure, and that's probably the most important clinical measurement that's ever been made in the history of the planet, because every time you go to the doctor, maybe even if you go to the dentist nowadays, what do? They'll check your blood pressure, and they'll tell you, you know, it's 120 over 80, or they'll say, oh, it's 190 over 100, okay? And what happens if it's greater than 120 over 80? What do we call that? Hypertension, or high blood pressure. And high blood pressure probably kills more people than just about anything else, at least in the United States, because it can produce strokes, heart attacks, all kinds of vascular disease. So hypertension is a very deadly disease, so it's really good that you know about it, and it should be treated, because it eventually will kill you. There's a number of different reasons why somebody could have high blood pressure, and we're not sure exactly in some people why it is high, but different drugs will work in different kinds of mechanisms. One kind of drug will decrease the force of contraction of the heart, make it a little bit weaker, so your blood pressure comes down. I don't think there's any medication that slows the heart down, but that might be a possibility sometime in the future, a drug that slows the heart down, that will decrease your blood pressure. Another kind of drug, and we'll see how that works, maybe on the next slide, you can take a diuretic, and that will decrease your blood pressure. And the mechanism for that is actually pretty simple to see. Think of your car tire, and your tire should have a certain pressure in there, right? Okay. And if your pressure in the tire is low, do you put air in or take air out if it's low? Yeah, you put air pressure in. But if the tire pressure is too high, what do? You take air out, right? And the same thing for your cardiovascular system. If your blood pressure is too high, you take a diuretic, because what do when you take a diuretic? Yeah, you pee a lot. You lose fluid from your body, and it takes it from your circulatory system. That's taking fluid out of your circulatory system that brings your blood pressure down. Okay. So when people have hypertension, they might not take just one medication. They'll maybe take a number of different medications that work in different ways. Okay, one might be a diuretic, one might slow the activity or weaken the heart, or a combination actually works best. All right, so if you know somebody that has hypertension, you should really be supportive of them to make them stay, help them stay on their medication, because it can be a very deadly disease. And the sad thing about it, when you have hypertension and you're treated, when your blood pressure goes to normal, that's when you feel bad. And when you have high blood pressure, the blood pressure that's killing you, that's when you feel good. That's a really strange thing about hypertension. So people that have hypertension have a tendency not to stay medicated because they feel bad when they're medicated. But it might take them a year to get over that feeling. So you really got to say, oh yeah, we're proud of you, please do it, stay on that medication. Okay? Because it's going to take a while for them to get feeling back to normal again. Yeah. Low blood pressure, okay? Well, the higher the pressure is, the more susceptible you are to cardiovascular disease and strokes and things like that. The lower your blood pressure is, the less susceptible you are to those kinds of things. So low blood pressure sounds Fantastic. Okay. Okay. Well, low blood pressure, I think, is fantastic because you're less susceptible to all these other kinds of disease processes, kidney failure, arterial sclerosis, heart failure, okay, even having an aneurysm in your brain, all that kind of stuff. Okay, now the only time where low blood pressure might be bad is if, for instance, you're sitting down or you're lying down and you get up and you pass out. That could happen if you have really low blood pressure. And, of course, that's bad because if you stand up and pass out, what's going to happen? Well, you're going to hit your head on the table, and then you're going to hit your head on the floor, and it's going to hurt, right? Or maybe you do something in your car when you're driving and you pass out. Then what happens? Well, then you're going to crash into people, right? So low blood pressure, if it's so bad that you're passing out, we call syncope, then that's bad and it should be treated. But if you're functioning fine and you have low blood pressure, guess what? You're really, really, really lucky. Yeah, because you're probably never going to get a heart attack or vascular disease as a result of that. Who had a question? Yeah. You know, it doesn't slow down the heart. It doesn't have much an effect on the heart. But when you drink alcohol, it is a diuretic. Right? It does make you pee. You know, there could be some cardioprotective effects of drinking some because it acts as a diuretic. You're going to lose blood volume. But depending on what you drink, also might be protective of your heart. We think that there are certain chemicals in grapes, especially red grapes, that are protective of your heart and your vascular system. So if you drink red wine, that's an antidote. At least I like to think it's an antidote to heart disease. Or you could probably just drink grape juice as well. That doesn't have alcohol in it and still get those same class of chemical compounds. Okay. But the other thing is too, if you have a drink every once in a while, that probably has a tendency to reduce stress in your life, which is cardioprotective as well. Right? So some things in moderation are very handy. But you know, I've probably known people to drink themselves to death just by drinking a six-pack of beer every day, you know? Now, and to a lot of people, six-pack is not very much, but that's probably enough to kill you. Okay, that will kill your liver. Okay. I guess I have to stop, and then we'll take a quiz. And then what? Spring break! And we'll see if it's snowing out there. It seemed like a really nice day, though.